All right, we are recording and broadcasting. The floor is yours.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the December 16, 2021 Delta Stewardship Council meeting. I'm Susan Tatayan, Chair of the Council, and I'm very grateful that we're able to be together virtually this morning. Please excuse our late start. We were having some technical difficulties, and we'll try to roll through the meeting more quickly as a result. So, council members, let's establish a quorum with a roll call, starting with Virginia Madueño.
Good morning, Madueño here.
Maria Maranian.
Iranians here.
Don Natoli.
Good morning, Don Natoli's here.
Christy Smith.
Good morning, Christy Smith here.
Daniel Zingali.
Good morning, Daniel here.
Susan Tatayan here, and we are expecting Judge Damrell shortly after some technical difficulties are sorted out. So if any member of the public is interested in providing public comment, please send an email blue card to the clerk at engage@deltacouncil.ca.gov as seen on the screen. Well, I don't know if you can see it on the screen, but again, that's engage@deltacouncil.ca.gov. Be sure to note your name and the agenda item that you wish to comment on. And when your name is called, the clerk will unmute you. So on to agenda item three, the consent calendar. Council members, this is an action item. We have, looks like three items. Is there any public comment on this item?
No, Madam Chair, there is not.
Members, approval of the consent calendar?
Okay, motion by Councilmember Smith.
I'll second.
To approve, second by Councilmember Madueño. Any need for discussion on the consent calendar items? Or any objection? Okay, hearing none, the motion is adopted by unanimous consent. Let's move on to agenda item four, the chair's report. For the chair's report this morning, we have before us election of the vice chair. It's been quite a while since we've had a vice chair, so we're overdue. And we do need to nominate someone to be vice chair.
Is this now? Should we nominate?
Sure.
Yeah, yes, I'll nominate Council Member Madueño.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion to nominate Council Member Madueño by Council Member Marion. It was second by Council Member Smith. Are there any public comments on this item?
No, Madam Chair, there are not.
All right, well then let's move to the vote. Those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any, and those opposed, please say nay or no.
Nay.
Well, okay. The ayes have it. So we're assuming, Virginia, that you accept this nomination.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Yes, I humbly and proudly accept the nomination and very happy to step up and assist you as your vice chair. And again, looking forward to a new chapter in bringing more attention, if you will, to our council, to the work that we do, the advocacy role that we play. And again, a pleasure. And thank you so much to my peers, and looking forward to an exciting 2022.
Yes, great. Thank you, Virginia, and congratulations.
Thank you.
So on to agenda, just one more item under the chair's report. I wanted to share very quickly with you, if you haven't seen it yet, there's an award-winning video, a documentary called River's End, California's Latest Water War. And it is really well done. It covers the basics, but it also covers some of the politics. And it has great illustrations of our water system. And in chapter two, it has these chapters. Chapter two is titled, "The Delta is the Big Story." And I'll just read a quote quickly. It just really struck me what Professor Char Miller said in this documentary. He said, "There's no stage bigger than the Bay Delta to help us articulate what's going to make us more nimble, what's going to make our communities more just, and what's going to make this planet still habitable by human beings." Pretty amazing statement. Anyway, I highly recommend watching it. The documentary is available on Apple TV, Google Play, Prime Video, and other streaming services.
What is the name? Rivers and California Water?
Rivers End.
Uh-huh.
California's Latest Water War. And in the documentary, you'll see some folks who have come before the council at public comment times. So worth the watch. On to agenda item five, public comment on any item not on the council's agenda today.
No, Madam Chair, there's not.
All right. Well, then let's move on to agenda item six, executive officer's report with Jessica Pearson.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Tatayan. As I mentioned at last month's meeting, staff have prepared a proposal to revise the council's appeals procedures for covered actions. The proposed revisions are designed to address lessons learned while processing the appeals received by the council over the past 3 years, and are intended to improve the process for all parties. These appeals procedures that we have in place now were adopted by the council in its first year of business in 2010, before we had experienced covered actions and before we had had any appeals. So it's time to update them. Staff released a draft version of the proposed amendments on our website on December 10th for a 90-day public comment period, ending March 7th, 2022. Interested persons may view the proposed amendments on our website, and you can submit comments to procedures@deltacouncil.ca.gov. We don't currently have any active covered action certifications. There are two letters in your board packet to report on this month. One is a letter that was sent to the council. It was submitted on December 1st from Solano County Supervisor John Vasquez regarding the Lookout Slough Tidal Habitat Restoration and Flood Improvement Project. The letter states that Solano County, the Department of Water Resources, and the Department of Fish and Wildlife have entered into a memorandum of understanding to collaborate and identify opportunities to expand and enhance recreation within the Cache Slough region. The second letter is from the council to the West Sacramento Area Flood Control Agency, submitted on December 6th, regarding the draft supplemental environmental analysis for the Yolo Bypass East Levee Project. The project proposes levee improvements, roadwork, and improving the levee drainage system of the Yolo Bypass East Levee in West Sacramento. The supplemental document addresses design changes from the final environmental impact report. The letter from the council states that the project appears to meet the definition of a covered action. And so in the letter, we outline Delta Plan policies that may be relevant, and we invite the Flood Control Agency to meet with council staff in early consultation. I have one personnel announcement regarding a recent promotion. Aaron Mullen has been promoted to Supervising Water Resources Engineer in the Planning and Performance Division. Aaron has been with the council for 5 years and has been front and center on the development and collaborative efforts on the Delta Levees investment strategy. In her new position, she will lead the council's work related to water resource planning and also flood control and water supply reliability efforts. So my congratulations to Aaron. I would now like to invite Assistant Planning Director Harriet Ross to the microphone to provide a quick update on our ongoing process of developing the second phase of Delta Adapts, which is our climate adaptation strategy for the Delta region. Harriet, are you on?
Moving her over now.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Tutayan, members of the council. It's good to see all of you right for the holidays. Wanted to give you a quick update on Delta Adapts. If we could please share the PowerPoint and then go straight to slide two, please. We started off our adaptation strategy last month with a stakeholder work group meeting. We had about 50 participants representing many sectors and environmental groups, liaisons to the ag
community. The webinar ID, it says the number.
Someone was making a comment. So back to the stakeholder work group. We had a number of representatives, 50 participants representing many sectors. We asked a series of questions relating to having participants tell us what they value, priorities for adaptation, what factors to consider when looking at trade-offs of adaptation. We also asked participants to tell us what they think a resilient Delta would look like in the future. We received a lot of feedback, as you can see on the Jamboard here. Just want to give you an illustration of the type of feedback that we got. There are several of these types of boards. We got a lot of input. Next slide, please. We're still going through the comments that we received. If we can advance to the next slide. I'll just keep going. We got a lot of feedback and we're still going through the comments right now. However, some just wanted to share some of what we did here. Mostly what we expected, the comments that we did receive, that's really to balance the various interests and needs in the Delta, multi-benefit projects, the need to protect the economy, specifically related to regional agriculture, vulnerable communities and legacy towns from climate change. We also heard, many of the Delta stakeholders know where flood improvements are needed, under current conditions, and they just really need the resources to make these improvements. There was also a lot of concern for impacts to water supply reliability from sea level rise and increased salinity. We also heard about subsidence reversal really needs to occur at an adequate scale to make a difference across the basins and the islands. And we also heard a bit from the ag community or the liaisons to the agricultural folks. And what they're saying is adapting to agriculture may mean more diversified vision of what working lands includes. Really, for example, looking at carbon and tule farming, manage wetlands for biofuels, more rice production, for example, and to really maintain productivity of any type. Farmers really need the reliability to predict the conditions of the season. And that's really related to water levels, salinity, sediment. And they really need that reliability to make those decisions on what to plant and how to move forward. And also, we really need to consider who will be harmed by climate change the most, who will benefit or lose from implementation of different adaptation approaches. And what we heard is that those affected the most should really be involved in the process. And on to the next slide. After the stakeholder work group meeting we had in November, we formed four focus groups to cover flooding, ecosystem, water supply, reliability, and agriculture. And the purpose of these focus groups was really to dive into the details of these topics for adaptation. So three of our four focus groups met over the last week, and just wanted to give you some of the key highlights from those meetings. So for the water supply reliability focus group, we did partner with, we're partnering with the department as well as Water Board staff and Office of the Delta Water Master. We had, you know, to really plan and come up with the questions that we asked this group. And so some of the highlights of that meeting we heard included a lot of concern that climate change impacts would reduce storage that could increase demands on groundwater and the need for water transfers, as well as potentially reduce water supply to address water quality. We also talked a bit about adaptation actions and some potential things that we should consider. And that included revised water management and reoperations to provide more system flexibility, consider water supply infrastructure improvements for more flexibility and to capture high flows for storage and supply, as well as considering new or amended regulations to allow for more creative partnerships and transparency in reporting. And we also spent some time talking about desired outcomes for water supply reliability. We talked about developing more water storage, optimizing upstream, onstream reservoir operations, and having a more flexible water system. And then on the next slide, some of the key highlights from the ecosystem focus group we heard was really the importance of having a shared vision for the Delta that goes beyond opportunistic actions and really takes a whole systems view at restoration. Also looking at multi-benefit projects that can efficiently leverage the limited land area available for adaptation and the urgency of doing something now. The flood focus group had a long discussion. In fact, we couldn't get through the agenda and have to have a follow-up meeting. There was clearly a deep understanding that flooding consequences are severe in the Delta. And the focus group members really wanted us to be creative and really think outside of the box to think about adaptation solutions for flooding. And those solutions really need to serve multiple benefits. And this group is highly engaged and motivated to find solutions that are reflective of their interests and can truly help solve the issue and how we can adapt in the future. And on the next slide, just wanted to quickly go over how this input that we've been gathering through these processes will be used. And we'll be taking it to help us identify those adaptation approaches to consider by each of those technical topics. We'll be taking this input to help formulate the landscape-wide scenarios and really looking at identifying metrics and trade-offs for adaptation. And then ultimately, we'll be using this input to develop adaptation strategies that will show up in the document itself. And we are planning on two more stakeholder work group meetings and at least two more sets of focus group meetings. So we're in the very beginning of the process still. And then just wanted to end with the last slide here on our next steps. Our ag focus group will be meeting in mid-January. We are in the process of reaching out to landowners and farmers in the Delta, and we're hoping to engage this specific group in February timeframe, early next year. And then lastly, as part of the Environmental Justice Expert Panel that we have formed for the Environmental Justice Issue Paper, that group meets monthly, and we plan on talking about adaptation with this group in the spring time. And that's it for me. Any questions?
Done. Yeah, just thanks, Sherry. Question I have is on your outreach, are you doing these virtually or with the landowner farmer meeting in February? What database are used for your invite to that meeting. Again, I'm just kind of curious, obviously a lot of work, a lot of moving parts here, and appreciate the update, but I'm curious about that. Thanks.
Yeah, definitely. Right now we're planning on a virtual meeting. Things change quickly, so maybe, but that's what we're planning on right now. And our database is basically, just through our interactions with folks and conversations and our contacts through these boundary organizations that we're meeting with and are also planning on having that are part of the agricultural focus group. They're really connecting us to those growers and landowners. And the list is quite long at this point, but I'm happy to share it with you so you can add in, take a look and add any additions that you may have.
I don't have any specific suggestions. I trust you're working with the local farm bureaus who obviously have a network that, goes outside the boundaries of the Delta, but certainly they have a good understanding. And I might suggest, and again, might want to reach out to Eric or with the commission, Delta Protection Commission, and see if there's any additional folks. And maybe all those lists have already been merged. And so I trust you've done a thorough job. I just was curious as you pull this together, because I think it's some very important work. And I think that, this ongoing follow-up is really important to what we ultimately end up with on this, on the whole plan. So appreciate that. Thanks.
Virginia.
Yes, thank you. Harriet, thank you so much for the presentation. As always, love hearing what you have to present. Just a quick question with regard to the focus group. If you could share some of the demographics of who's included in this group. Maybe some just general background area that they cover, just some generalities would be great.
Yeah, certainly. So first of all, we did do an open wide call to join the focus groups at our stakeholder work group meeting. But generally, I would say, and they vary for each of the focus groups. So for flooding, we obviously have a Central Valley Flood Protection Board representatives, as well as reclamation district engineers and local flood control agencies. That's probably the bulk of the flood group. We also have, for water supply, we're teaming with, the Department of Water Resources, as well as the State Water Board representatives. We also have the State Water Contractor representatives, and just basically folks that have been very involved in water supply in the Delta. Those are the folks in that group. For ag, it's pretty big. We have the local farm bureaus. We have the UC Cooperative Extension. We do have some landowners on that list as well, but it's not as big because we were trying to keep these focus groups manageable. And then after the feedback we received at the stakeholder work group, we decided to really expand and create a separate group of those landowners and farmers. We've also invited farm labor groups. We haven't had very much success in that, however, in getting participation. So those are kind of, that ag focus group is quite large. There's a lot of boundary organizations that we have and CDFA contacts as well that make up that group. And then for ECO, it's mostly state agencies, CDFW representatives, GWR representatives from ECO Restore, and DPC and the Conservancy are part of that focus group as well. So that just, there's more, I'm sure I'm missing it, but those are the main folks of those groups.
Got it. Okay. Thank you so much. Appreciate that.
Any other questions for Harriet? Harriet, I have a question. Is there some point where you'll have outreach that intermingles the focus groups?
Yes, and that will happen at the stakeholder work group level. So we were trying to, make sure we weren't taking up too much time. So that's why we had these breakout in the focus groups to dive into the details, but all of the various interests will come together at the stakeholder work group level. And those meetings are interspersed in between major milestones of the focus groups.
Excellent. Yeah, I was just thinking about adaptation strategies that link, for example, flood risk management with water supply management, and it'd just be good to see what comes out of the larger groups and hear how the discussions go.
Absolutely.
Well, if council members have no other questions, then we'll move on to public comment. Is there any public comment?
Actually, sorry, Chair, I have just a little bit more.
Okay.
Thank you, Harriet. I just want to quickly preview the agenda. First, the council will receive an update on the recently released draft 2022 to 2026 Science Action Agenda. This is the culmination of almost 2 years of collaborative work and outreach to identify collective Delta science priorities. Next, the Delta Protection Commission staff will give an overview of the draft Great Delta, California Delta Trail Master Plan. This was recently released and it's currently available for public comment. The master plan and the Great California Delta Trail advance implementation of recommendations that are within our Delta plan in the Delta is Place chapter. And lastly, council staff will present updates on key Delta plan performance measures from the past year and report on performance measure dashboard use. We have a dashboard on our website in 2021. And with that, I'll take any questions, but I conclude my executive officer's report. Thank you, Chair.
Certainly. Any questions for Jessica? Okay. Hearing none, now we'll move to public comment. Any public comment on this item?
No, Madam Chair, there's not.
All right, well, then we'll move on to agenda item 7, lead scientist report with Dr. Laurel Larson.
Thank you, Chair Tatayan, and good morning, council members. Happy December. I have a meaty and hopefully interesting lead scientist report in store for you today, so I'm just going to go and jump right in. But Beck, could you please bring up the slide for the article spotlight? And today I'm going to set the stage for the article spotlight by referring back to a few other papers that I've covered in the last year, kind of a year in review, if you will. When I covered Jim Clern's historical analysis of primary productivity in the Delta in June, you learned that the Delta has lost 77% of its wetlands, but 89% of its carbon supply to the food web, as wetlands are such abundant suppliers of food. The massive loss of food supply to Delta food webs is one of the factors implicated in pelagic organism decline, or the precipitous drop in the populations of four native fish species around the turn of the century. Last February, we also learned about how in the Nigiri project written up by Ted Sommer, rice fields in the Yolo bypass were inundated to provide rearing habitat for salmon, with the finding that these managed inundation experiments were very effective at producing abundant zooplankton and rearing fish, given appropriate connectivity to the main channel. That Nigiri project is a great example of a managed flow action that is designed to increase fish access to habitat. Another type of managed flow action that we've also touched on, which is also designed to promote access to habitat, is the operation of the Sassoon Marsh salinity control gates to freshen Sassoon, which is something that we touched upon in my overview of Cameron Gallenbaur's synthesis of drivers of Delta salinity back in August. Today, I'm going to discuss a third type of flow action that, unlike these other two actions, was not just used to improve habitat locally, but was really designed to change regional flow and transport patterns with the intent of transporting more fish food, phytoplankton, to the lower part of the estuary. Collectively, flow actions such as these are innovative strategies for potentially enhancing resilience of species like Delta smelt to drought, or simply to the poor food conditions that exist in the estuary. And these actions often come up in planning discussions. However, the number of times that they've been implemented as adaptive management experiments is relatively small, leading to their prioritization in the 2022 to 2026 Science Action Agenda, which you'll hear about shortly, under Action 1C, which is to identify and carry out large-scale experiments that can address uncertainties in the outcomes of management actions for ecosystem function in the Delta. So the flow action that I'm going to talk to you today, which is profiled in this article, is the 2016 North Delta Flow Action. This action was really directed toward Delta smelt, which, like other native fish species, has suffered from a decline in food. One part of the Delta that's known to provide good habitat for the Delta smelt is the Cache Slough Complex in the North Delta, shown here on this map. This region retains some of the more complex tidal channels that were characteristic of the historic Delta, and it's connected to the Yolo Bypass with its higher plankton densities. While we know that this area generates phytoplankton that contributes to downstream food webs during the wet winter and the spring, this role is repressed during dry summers when upstream diversions induce a negative upstream flow through the region that directs food resources away from the lower estuary. 2012, however, featured unusually high agricultural flows during the summer through the Yolo Bypass and the Cache Slough Complex, and did not generate those negative flows. Instead, the high downstream summer flows helped trigger the first fall phytoplankton bloom in the upper estuary in over two decades. So with those 2012 observations as inspiration, a large team of researchers and managers from DWR, USBR, CDFW, NIMS, Fish and Wildlife Service, US Geological Survey, the Resources Agency, and local universities partnered with diverters to generate a summer flow pulse lasting for 2 weeks in July of 2016. That action constituted part of the collaborative Delta Smelt Resilience Strategy. The source of the flow was agricultural drain water, which was rerouted through the Yolo Bypass instead of being directed to the Sacramento River. Now, to do this successfully, the water level of the Sacramento River needed to be raised, and that was accomplished through modified operations of the Keswick Dam. So this was an action that required a tremendous amount of coordination and planning. The researchers modeled how flows responded to that action, and then they measured changes in nutrients, zooplankton, and phytoplankton. The results from this 2016 action just came out in San Francisco Estuary and Watershed Sciences in a paper led by Jared Francik at DWR, and a team of other authors from DWR and Anchor QEA. Now, the biggest findings were that the action was successful in generating a large volume of downstream flow through that target region. And that flow stimulated a bloom of a beneficial species of phytoplankton downstream. Now, whether the flow action by itself was sufficient to stimulate this phytoplankton bloom was a bit uncertain, as the species involved in the bloom had been prevalent in the Delta prior to the flow action. So there was abundant seed material for this phytoplankton available in the bottom sediments already. And indeed, when a similar flow action was undertaken in 2018, which was not reported on in this particular paper, a bloom did not result, which has been attributed to the different pre-flow conditions and the lack of a prior bloom in that year. Now, the flow action also generated higher numbers. Oh, and Beck, I forgot to ask you to move to the next slide, which will just show you the difference in these measured quantities after the flow pulse. Thanks. I'll say that the flow action also generated higher numbers of zooplankton in the Cache Slough complex during the flow pulse, but there was little evidence that those zooplankton were exported downstream. So in all, the North Delta flow action generated promising results for how we might intervene to enhance Delta smelt resiliency during dry summers. It also created additional science questions, which subsequent flow actions in 2018 and 2019 were designed to address. Now, results from those two experiments are still being analyzed and were not reported on in this paper, but in brief, those experiments revealed that while the food delivery system was less effective than in 2016, there was still more fish food in the lower Yolo Bypass and Cache Slough than before this action or this food delivery system was implemented. And in fact, I'll just point out that there is a really great Frontiers for Young Minds article about it. We talked about the special issue of that journal, Frontiers for Young Minds, that's focused on the Delta. This article about the flow actions was published in September, and I encourage you to check it out. It's titled Delivering Food to Hungry Fish in the San Francisco Estuary. So I'm going to pause there for questions on this particular article, and then I'll segue into the rest of the report.
Good question for you, Dr. Larson, Madam Chair. Yeah.
Yes, please proceed.
Yeah, Laura, just as I was listening to you talk about the time periods, if recollection serves me correct, 2011 was a wet year, and then we had several dry years, including 2016, and then 2017 was another wet year, and mentioned work that was done that hasn't yet been analyzed, I guess, fully for 2018 and 19. These are summer pulse flows, as I understand it, but or later in the season. Is there any correlation or at least attribution of what may occur? You mentioned 2012, and then again, obviously, 2018 and 2016. I'm just curious about that when we have these wetter either than normal and or go through periods of fairly dry, if not extreme drought in some cases. And obviously, the reservoir system still continues to maintain flows in the river, but, you know, with some other impacts. So I'm just curious about that, Dr. Wells.
This is a big part of the question, and I'm glad I'm glad you asked it, because it relates nicely to something I'm going to talk about later on. So really, you know, understanding how the history with respect to how wet it was in the past, what sorts of organisms really populated the food chain in the past year, past 2 years, even in some cases, that is a really big question in terms of how that history impacts responses to flow actions that we might do like this. And in fact, there's a big black box when it comes to understanding how these food webs work in the Delta. We have a lot of measurements of phytoplankton. We don't have very many measurements of zooplankton, as we mentioned a few meetings ago. But how that lower level or that base of the food web is connected to fish at the top, and what the influence of other environmental drivers like flows and temperatures are, that's really poorly understood. And that's something that requires really statistically savvy people to put these different data sets together and do that really challenging synthesis. And I'm going to say a lot about this in a moment, but I'm really glad you asked the question.
Yeah, well, thank you. I find it very fascinating, again, because I know so little about science, but as you present these, and just, again, the graphics, as I've said before, and others have too, that really do, I think, help to break it down and understandable. And then as you provide the narrative behind it, I think it just furthers the understanding. So thanks again, Dr. Larson.
You're welcome. And I'll just credit this graphic, as every graphic is credited, to Karen Gutierrez, who's our state policy fellow. Any other questions before I move on? So I don't see anyone. Cut in if I missed you. But with that, I think I will segue to the rest of the report. And that was a really great question, as I said, because it connects to the next thing I'm going to talk about, which is a report out on a partnership that the Delta Science Program engaged in with the National Center for Analysis and Synthesis. And I'm going to start by saying quite a bit about the motivation for this partnership, and then I'll talk about their methods. But in this article spotlight, and we could probably take the slide down now, we discussed how flow actions are being used to generate food for fish. But then at the end, we talked about how the different flow actions in the North Delta over the years had fairly varied results. Now, these results underscore that we don't totally understand how to generate more food for native fishes, because as I was just saying, the food web is a bit of a black box. The Collaborative Adaptive Management Team, or CAMT, and other collaborative groups in the Delta have discussed a need for developing predictive tools, models, that will help us anticipate the outcome of a given flow action, which can then help us decide whether and when to implement these costly, high-effort endeavors. These calls for food web models echo a call from the Independent Science Board just in the beginning part of this year in their invasive species report, which specifies food web models as a critical need. In particular, the report demonstrates how these models can help us make connections in advance between habitat restoration or flow actions and benefits for native fishes. So what is the big gap here? Well, for decades, through the Interagency Ecological Program and other entities, we've collected monitoring data on phytoplankton and environmental drivers and fish species. This really constitutes a big data set in the classical sense. But individual data collection efforts are typically focused on individual species or groups of species, but there's not necessarily coordination across the different components of the food web. And similarly, funding for data collection does not often extend to funding for analysis. These issues are not unique to the Delta by any stretch, but are pervasive across the environmental sciences. It can be very challenging, costly, and time-consuming to use existing data to address holistic questions about the system because data sets are often not compatible, or at least not readily compatible. For instance, they might have different formats, different timestamps, and different assumptions that were invoked in the data processing. And up until recently, many of them may not have been accessible, though AB 1755 is changing that for the better. Another challenge is that the techniques for analyzing big data are also evolving rapidly, and scientists who were trained as subject matter experts often don't have the skills to do this analysis in a way that answers those big questions of what is causing what in these complex systems. So these challenges often can thwart seeing the return on scientific investment, because without those big picture analyses, we really can't answer some of the biggest questions relevant to management needs. Synthesis is an approach. Synthesis is the answer here. It's an approach to scientific discovery that allows us to look across individual data collection efforts and answer big picture questions about the whole system. Synthesis is an increasingly critical science need, and it's also one of the core functions of the Delta Science Program. But the synthesis needs are far bigger than any one agency can tackle. I'm told that former lead scientist Peter Goodwin used to say that solutions for managing the Delta more sustainably lie in the data that's already been collected. It just needs to be unlocked. Delta Science Program engaged in its partnership with the National Center for Ecological Analysis and Synthesis as a way to provide training to our broader community of scientists so as to enable far more agencies and scientists to perform this needed synthesis. So through the NC's DSP partnership, a working group of 19 participants from 9 agencies and universities convened for 3 weeks of training and collaborative work, which took place at UC Davis in person in September, October, and November. Now, given the urgent need for synthesis to understand controls on the estuarine food web, the working group focused on applying their training to addressing that challenge. Through the summer, DSP staff and NCs pulled together the data that would be needed to analyze relationships between these different components of the food web and environmental factors, effectively producing a ready-to-go database that will also be made accessible to others outside the working group as one of their products. The 19 participants worked with and continue to work with this data set in 2 working subgroups, which are focused on understanding the effect of flood management on estuary health, and then on identifying drivers of food web dynamics on an estuary scale. The preliminary results are going to be presented internally in January, and a series of outputs is expected in mid to late 2022. And I know a lot of people are really excited about these results. The expected outputs include peer-reviewed publications, presentations, and fact sheets that translate the scientific analyses to meet management needs. And they're also going to produce broadly accessible data and models that others can reuse. So I look forward to providing you with future updates, but they just completed their three weeks of in-person work. So wanted to report out now on that initiative and what they're trying to do. So that was a rather long overview, but it's really important because I think that synthesis in general is not well understood. And it's a growing need. And it's one of the aspects of the science that we do that I think has the greatest potential to address some of the biggest management questions. So with that, I'm going to talk a little bit about another ongoing initiative, which is the Environmental Justice Initiative. And I'll refer you to your packet because there's a great update there, a very detailed update on what's happening with our Environmental Justice or EJ initiative. And just as a reminder, the Council's 2019 five-year review report identified EJ as a priority issue and recommended preparation of an issue paper to investigate the need for additional strategies or responses to address EJ within the Delta Plan. Also to summarize the best available science and identify future policy options for the Council to consider. The preparation of that issue paper was initiated in February of 2021. And then recently, the Council began doing outreach to EJ organizations and community-based organizations to arrange for interviews that will inform the EJ issue paper. Council staff intend to conduct approximately 30 interviews from a broad set of groups working across many different EJ issues and in different regions of the Delta. And I just want to flag this for you because if you or someone you work with would be interested and willing to interview, or if you have feedback or questions on the approach, please contact Council staff at the email address that's included in your packet under this item. So another topic that I'm excited to report out on is that the Delta Interagency Invasive Species Coordination Team, or DISC, symposium, which is a biennial event, was held just yesterday. In 2013, the Delta Interagency Invasive Species Coordination Team was formed to foster communication and collaboration among California state agencies that detect, prevent, and manage invasive species and restore invaded habitats in the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta. Participants in DISC include state agency program managers and scientists, research and conservation groups, federal agencies, and other stakeholders. And the Delta Stewardship Council is a co-chair of that team. As outlined in the Invasive Species Coordination Framework, the goals of the DISC team are to establish a framework for strategic planning, coordinated implementation, education and outreach, data management, research needs, and funding. And one way that they do this is by holding this biennial symposium. Yesterday's symposium focused on the challenge of early detection and rapid response to species invasions once they're detected. And this is commonly referred to as EDRR. EDRR is a second line of defense for our system once prevention measures have failed. Eradication at these early stages before the species has had a chance to get established and spread is the most cost-effective and efficient way to protect our system from the ongoing threat of invasive species. Sessions at the symposium focused on lessons learned from EDRR efforts in other systems, successes and setbacks in EDRR efforts in the Delta, and emerging EDRR tools and challenges. The Council was well represented at the meeting. I gave an opening talk. We also had Emily Reisner and Louise Conrad moderate sessions and a panel, respectively. Rachel Klopfenstein and Emily Reisner were also involved in the planning committee for the meeting. And Steve Brandt of the Independent Science Board gave a plenary talk on the ISB's invasive species review. The symposium laid a great foundation for developing a framework for implementing EDRR in a systematic way in the Delta. And this helps advance Action 3D of the 2022 to 2026 Science Action Agenda, which is to synthesize existing knowledge and conduct applied interdisciplinary research to evaluate the costs and benefits of different strategies for minimizing introduction and spread of invasive species and to inform early detection and rapid response strategies. So there's a few other upcoming seminars that should be on your radar. One is the Adapting Restoration for a Changing Climate Symposium that I discussed last month. I won't provide the details again now, but I just want to remind you that that's going to be on February 2nd to 3rd. The main news is that registration for that meeting is now available, and a full agenda is going to be released on December 20th on the Delta Science Program's Adaptive Management webpage. And second, we now have dates for the upcoming salinity management workshops, which I also covered in detail last month. Just as a quick reminder, these workshops are designed to lay the groundwork for collaborative development of a suite of scenarios to evaluate alternative salinity management strategies, such as the use of salinity barriers, modified water operations, and implementation of restoration in the face of a changing climate, and identify what the impacts would be on Delta communities, ecosystems, and water supply. So the dates for the workshop are going to be April 26th through 27th for the first one, and then October 11th through 12th for the second one. I do have a note in my packet or in my notes that I just wanted to let you know that the Science Action Agenda public draft is available for comment until January 21st, but I'm going to spare discussion of any details because you will hear about that next. And the other quick update is that we have a release date for the Delta Science Fellows Program, RFA, which will be coming out on January 25th. So I'll probably report on this in January in detail, but please help us spread the word that this great opportunity is coming available for master's students, PhD students, and postdoctoral scholars. And this year, one new feature of that fellows RFA is that we have a separate track devoted to social science projects. And then finally, I'll wrap up with my By the Numbers report. Unfortunately, I haven't rerun the numbers since this last big storm, but as of December 13th, the Northern Sierra has received 149% of its average precipitation to December 13th, although snow water equivalent is still just 38% of the average. So this is a measure of the snowpack. And that might be because we've had such warm temperatures and that does not facilitate a strong snowpack. In the Central Sierra, 103% of the average precipitation has been received to December 13th. Again, I expect those numbers to be much higher now. And I particularly expect the snowpack numbers to be much higher after this last storm. I've heard that the mountains have gotten dumped on. But what we're looking at in the reservoirs is still approximately the same as last month. Shasta is at 44% of its average, Oroville at 60%, and San Luis Reservoir at 42%. And this is because we really need a lot more rain to fill up all of that available pore space in soils before we start generating more runoff to rivers, which eventually makes it into the reservoirs. I'll note that Jay Lund on the Independent Science Board had a great tweet this week. The tweet basically showed that we're on track right now to, this water year is on track to as the third highest in terms of precipitation. And just to put some numbers in perspective, California's big October storm was 12 inches of precipitation here. The last couple of days added about another 5 inches. And Jay Wright said it will take about 6 more storms like this week's to achieve average annual precipitation for the water year and more still to end the drought. So we've had a great start to the water season, a really wet start to the water season, but there's still a long way to go to meet our water needs here in Northern California. So that's the end of my report, and I'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you, Doctor. This is Daniel. Thanks again for another interesting, outstanding report, and especially for all the teamwork that goes behind a report like that. I have two quick questions. One is the reservoir averages that you just mentioned. Can you remind us how many years are those averages based on? What period of time do we draw the average from?
Do you remember? I don't remember exactly how many years it is. It is decades, though.
That's all I needed.
Yeah, the available record.
Yeah, that's a big range we're covering there. And then I appreciated the environmental justice report. Could you give us a little bit more texture? I know we don't have a lot of time, but I'd just like to have a better sense of who we're hearing from. What are they telling us? What's the volume of input coming in, the range? you just give us a little more detail on that, please?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't have the information on that available, but Dr. Jess Rudnick is the point person, and I can check in with her to get some information on who has responded already and who they're reaching out to. So I could definitely put you in touch with her.
Okay, I'd appreciate that. Thank you so much.
No problem.
Question?
Councilmember Natale.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Larson. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just back to the work on the invasives. Is that all inclusive? It's not just vegetation, it's mammals, it's organisms, you know, up the food chain. So when you talk about invasives, it's the whole spectrum, Dr. Larson.
Yeah, that's correct. And yesterday at the symposium, we heard about taxa ranging from bacteria all the way up to nutria. And so it really covered everything. There were specific discussions about aquatic weeds, mussels, of course, nutria. Yeah, not as much discussion of invasive fish yesterday, but that's, you know, that's something right. We deal with regularly as well.
Right. And again, I'm sorry, I wasn't able to tune in yesterday, but I assume the website has some of the papers and presentations that were presented as a part of that, or comments that were offered via at least written communications. Is that available to folks or not?
I will find out for you.
Okay. If you could, I know I had it tentative in my calendar. It didn't happen yesterday for me, but I would like to, you know, follow up.
I'm fairly sure the meeting was recorded, and I'll find out how you can access
it. Okay, that'd be great. Okay, good. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Virginia.
Dr. Larson, again, always a pleasure to listen to you. I just, your wealth, if you will, of knowledge is just amazing. A couple of questions with regard to the Environmental Justice Initiative and the interviews that have been conducted. In your opinion, is there anything that has popped out at you that was of surprise with regard to the Environmental Justice Initiative that you didn't know that maybe is more apparent now? And what areas is that covering?
So that's a great question. And again, I'll have to refer you to Jessica Rudnick for an answer. My understanding is that the interview process is just getting kicked off. So organizations are, that team is very much in the preliminary phase of reaching out to organizations. So I'm not sure that we can say that there's any surprising information that's been generated just yet. I know there's a lot of interest in what this group is doing. And I do look forward to reporting out on that a little bit later. Right now, really, what they're looking for is suggestions on groups to contact to ensure that their representation of organizations and individuals is as broad as possible within the realm of environmental justice. So, so they're still very much at early phases, but I could certainly put Jessica Rudnick in contact with you and Daniel Zingali for more coordination and communication about this.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
So Jessica, maybe we can, and Susan, maybe we can make it an item on the agenda for a future meeting.
Yeah, good idea. Yes.
Yeah, that makes Daniel. A lot of sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that is a great idea. And just a quick update. Rachel Klopfenstein sent me a message saying that the invasive species coordination team recording will be made available in coming weeks. And so I'll make sure that link to the recording is included in the next lead scientist report.
Any other questions for Dr. Larson? Okay. Is there any public comment on this item?
No, Madam Chair, there is not.
Well, then thank you, Dr. Larson. Let's move on to agenda item 8, the science action agenda update. And is Dr. Are you introducing?
Yes, I'm going to stay on. I am delighted to introduce Rachel Klopfenstein, a senior environmental science within the Delta Science Program, to provide a presentation on the 2022 to 2026 Science Action Agenda update. She has been the team lead on this item. And I guess the other thing I want to say about this is that this is, you know, this is widely recognized as a document that is produced by the scientific community for the scientific community. And it really helps us align our science priorities with the key management needs. And Rachel has gone through an extensive process to ensure that that alignment happens. So I will let her tell you more about that process.
Thank you very much, Laurel. I have some slides I think will be pulled up. And oh, perfect, there they are. All right, perfect. So good morning. Thank you so much, Laurel, for the introduction. And I will just say, my name is Rachel Klopfenstein, senior RMA scientist in the Delta Science Program's Collaborative Science and Peer Review Unit. And also on the line with us is Henry DeBay, the Environmental Program Manager for the unit. And we are here, and we're very excited that we're here to talk to you. And I'll be speaking on behalf of a larger team about the 2022 to 2026 Science Action Agenda, or SAA, for the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta. And the last time that we had the opportunity to present to the council was in August of last year. So we're excited to be back and provide you with an overview of the completed first draft. Next slide, please. But first, I just want to give a quick reminder on what the Science Action Agenda is and why it matters. As its name suggests, the SAA is a collaboratively developed agenda that prioritizes and aligns science actions to address management needs in the Delta. And it provides a unique service to the Council and the Delta Science Program, as well as to the broader Delta Science community. No other document elevates a list of shared science priorities for the Delta quite like the Science Action Agenda. And while the Delta Science Program facilitates the process, as Laurel mentioned, the Science Action Agenda is co-produced with stakeholder input and does encompass priorities from different collaborative venues and entities, thereby advancing shared interests and promoting transparency and collaboration. And we are extremely grateful for the tremendous interest in the Science Action Agenda development process. Since early 2020, noting that that's also the time that COVID began, so some challenges in terms of meeting in person, but since early 2020, we've engaged with over 30 collaborative groups, heard from over 125 workshop participants in very active and engaged workshops, and have gathered over 150 survey responses across multiple surveys. And I'll also note that the Science Action Agenda is called out in Governor Newsom's 2020 Water Resilience Portfolio as a potential statewide model for prioritizing science relating to water supply, water quality, and flood risk. And because the Science Action Agenda is a distillation of input from scientists, managers, and those with stake in the Delta Science Program and other agencies use it as a guide for science funding. The 2017 to 2021 Science Action Agenda has been used by the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, and the state water contractors, in addition to the science program, to allocate over $35 million for competitive research projects and graduate student fellowships over the last 5 years. And while these funding opportunities are primarily led by the science program, we're always looking to form partnerships and continue those we've already made. In addition to guiding funding calls, there are other uses. For example, a scientist in the system can use the SAA to see what science activities could be funded or what actions are of shared interest in the community. In viewing the Science Action Agenda, a manager can quickly see what priorities are shared with other entities. Next slide, please. And the 2022 to 2026 Science Action Agenda is the second full iteration of the SAA, though there were two similar efforts in the past. And all these previous efforts provide an opportunity to learn what worked and what could be improved and adaptively managed, kind of in our little cycle here. So first, in our planning stage, we changed the structure. We added management questions as a recommendation from the DPIC, Delta Plan Interagency Implementation Committee, DPIC's Science Funding and Governance Initiative in 2019. And the goal here was to better link science actions to the broader management needs. And this update also involved many more stakeholders and interests than the previous iteration, which was in response to calls for more co-production. There were many opportunities for engagement, including multiple online surveys and public workshops, which takes a lot of time. And the 2022 Science Action Agenda was also informed by the funded research from the previous funding solicitations and what we call our progress summary, which was an assessment and tracking of progress made on the 2017 to 2021 SAA. And this step, this progress summary step in particular, served to be really critical to the development process. In addition to determining the amount of funding that was allocated based on the last Science Action Agenda, we reviewed all activities that contributed to addressing the 25 science actions in the previous Science Action Agenda. We sought public input on the progress summary, and we released the final progress summary in the spring of this year. And the existing gaps, you know, like what did not get addressed, those were used to inform the development of new science actions that are in our draft now. And we'll continue to adaptively manage this science action agenda update process and welcome input. Next slide, please. So for the 2022 to 2026 science action agenda, the document and process has been organized into three hierarchical components, as shown by our pyramid diagram here, to ensure that the science actions are grounded in the management context. And management needs are at the top of this pyramid and are the broadest component, and we've landed on six, and we'll talk about those next. Below that, we have management questions, again, new for this iteration, which offer slightly more resolution on key management issues across the Delta and broader estuary. Through public outreach and input, we landed on 65 management questions, though not all of them directly relate to our priority science actions in the draft. And central, again, to all this are the science actions themselves, of which we've prioritized 25 in the draft based on input for funding in the near term. And we also had so many good suggestions for science actions that we actually chose to preserve 75 of them in the appendix of the document, so folks can see which ones were proposed but not prioritized for funding right now, but are still important. And now we'd like to give you a quick flavor of the management needs and the science actions themselves. So next slide, please. With the help of public input, the management needs we've landed on broadly relate to improving or assessing coordination of large-scale experiments or efforts across the system, monitoring, model integration and forecasting, multi-benefit approaches to managing the Delta as a social ecological system, building and integrating knowledge on human behavior and processes, acquiring new knowledge and synthesizing existing knowledge to support species recovery, and assessing and anticipating the impacts of climate change. Now, these six needs highlight information that's needed to inform decision-making, assessing scenarios, and enhancing Delta governance. And many of these needs relate to existing council priorities, including Delta Adapts and our efforts to enhance social science integration. Next slide, please. The science actions, again, there are 25 that have been proposed as priority for funding, are responsive to the management needs and the management questions, but I do want to highlight some of the specific themes or topics that the science actions cover. For example, enhancing forecasting and monitoring efforts to be more nimble, effective, and forward-looking, understanding impacts and management of contaminants and harmful algal blooms, which can have detrimental effects to people in the ecosystem, increasing knowledge on the Delta as an interconnected social ecological system with particular emphasis on understanding values, equity, and resilience, improving invasive species management, such as detecting and responding to invasive invasions earlier, and better anticipating and addressing climate change impacts that threaten the Delta. And here's one example, science action that's included in the draft related to the drought, or in general drought. So evaluating social and ecological trade-offs of drought management actions. And it's worth noting that in incorporating input and crafting the science actions, we sought to strike a balance between specific and broad, but broad enough to be inclusive of the input that we receive, but also responsive to the recognition of the system that we have management gaps that relate maybe less to individual processes and resources, but rather connections between processes and resources. And then we also have some science actions that are quite specific to advance key gaps in the system, like for species recovery. Next slide, please. The science action agenda is available for public review now, the draft, through January 21st of 2022. We released the draft in mid-November of this year. And we're seeking input from the Delta Independent Science Board, various collaborative groups, workshop participants, those that have participated in the process, and other interested members of the public and those with stake in the Delta. After considering comments, we anticipate releasing the draft by spring of 2022 and presenting that final to the council. Next slide, please. I now want to thank you all for your time this morning and also thank everyone who has been involved in the development process, especially those that are on the next slide, and now invite any of your questions or comments. Next slide, please. Thanks. No comments or questions is fine as well.
Thanks, Rachel.
Of course.
Did we lose our
chairperson? Yeah, absolutely. Chairperson Jatiah.
She got kicked off.
We got a vice chair now, Virginia.
Well, maybe we can move on to see if there's any public comment for the item.
There is. We have Deidre Desjardins.
Thank you. And I really appreciate the extensive public input process. I think this is incredibly important as the Delta faces the challenge of climate change. And I was struck, one of the Delta Independent Science Board members said that, 35 million isn't enough, and that actually the Delta needs a lot more money for research. It was Bob Nyman. So how to prioritize this is critically important. I did have a concern. I followed the IEP pelagic organism decline research. And I don't know if it was before your time, but they realized that all the pelagic species in the Delta had declined severely and abruptly. And IEP pulled together a pelagic organism decline management team, and they did 47 studies. Actually, I think it was, 47 or 57, and they did a big synthesis report in 2010. But I'm really concerned that there isn't follow-up because we failed. I mean, the Delta smelt is going extinct. And we need to look into that and not just attribute it to climate change, because that's a conclusion. I mean, the science action agenda only mentions, it doesn't mention extinction anywhere in the document. It mentions native species management under climate change. But I know because some of the stakeholders I work with were very concerned about the temporary urgency change petition, and they predicted that in the last drought, and they predicted that it would drive a Delta smelt extinct. And in fact, the smelt simply never recovered from the relaxation of water quality standards. So since the Delta ecosystem is such a critical part, we are going to be submitting comments. And we'd also, the other issue I have is I'd really like to see the advisory board, some transparency about the role of advisory council that was drawn from the Science Governance and Funding Initiative, and who is on it and what recommendations they gave about the science action agenda. Because that's very much dominated by the big players in water, which are, the big water agencies. And there is some concern that they're obfuscating issues that are critically important for management of California water and the Delta. Thank you.
Great. Is our chair back?
Beck, it sounds like she's having trouble getting back into the meeting. Can we send her an invitation or make sure that she's on the right side, the panelist?
Yes, I'll resend her a link.
Okay.
I think she's testing me.
Yeah. It's a pop quiz.
Out of the frying pan, into the fire. Are there any other public comments on this item, Beck?
There are not.
Well, next on the agenda, we have the Delta Protection Commission presenting on the Great Delta Trail Master Plan. So I'd like to welcome the Delta Protection Commission staff. They're going to present on the recently released draft. And as I mentioned earlier, the master plan advances implementation of numerous Delta Plan recommendations regarding the Delta as place. And the development of the trail really has the potential to boost recreation and tourism in the Delta for years to come. So I'm excited to hear the details of the presentation. And do we have Eric and Virginia Gardner on the presenter side?
I see.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, thank you, Jessica and Chair and Council members. I'm Eric Vink. I just want to briefly kick this off before I turn it over to Virginia Gardner. She is our program manager that has been managing the effort to prepare the Great California Delta Trail Master Plan. 2006 legislation tasked the commission with creating a plan to link the Bay Trail, which is along the Carquinez Strait in eastern Contra Costa County, with the Sacramento River Trail, now trails, because there are trail segments on both sides of the river in Sacramento and West Sacramento, to link those two. And it's been a long time since 2006, needless to say. In that intervening period of time, we've traveled a pretty windy route, as you can see from this serpentine figure here, and including preparing blueprints for the two segments, what we call the Western Blueprint, Solano and Contra Costa counties, and the Eastern Blueprint for the remaining three Delta counties, San Joaquin, Sacramento, and Yolo. And then most recently, we initiated an effort to prepare a master plan. The master plan is more of a strategic plan for how we get to a linked trail network through the Delta. We don't intend to be trail developers ourselves at the Delta Protection Commission, but to facilitate actions of local agencies who will be the entities that will be creating trail segments. And then ultimately, these can hopefully all link together. So with that as an introduction, I'd like to turn it over to our program manager, Virginia Gardner, to walk you through the Great California Delta Trail Master Plan and then some anticipated next steps in that process.
Thank you, Eric. Good morning, council members. I'm very happy to be here to provide an overview of the draft public review plan. Eric, the next slide, please. So this next slide will show our plan area. The study area is slightly different from other Delta zones because the Delta Trail will be connecting all the way from Sacramento to the Bay Area. So it includes the primary and secondary zones, as well as the Suisun Marsh and part, most actually, of the National Heritage Area. Next slide. The plan structure consists of five chapters with supporting information in the appendices. Briefly, chapter one will set the context with a high-level overview of the plan content and our outreach results. Chapter two covers existing conditions within the Delta that are most relevant to trail opportunities and challenges. Chapter three and chapter four dive into the substance of the plan. Chapter three by introducing the regions, regional maps, and recommendations, and the chapter four with our design element suggestions or guidelines. And then chapter five sets up how the trail would be implemented. The appendices include expanded information on items that were summarized in the plan, including the public survey results, literature review, sample design, designation process, checklist, as well as information about funding opportunities. And next slide, please. So just to give a quick overview of the chapters, this slide shows our public outreach results, a portion of them. This was a public survey conducted in summer of 2021, and we also included a focused outreach to levee managers during the late summer and early fall of 2021. And then, of course, we had ongoing coordination with our technical and stakeholder advisory committees as required by the Delta Trail legislation, which began in late 2019 and wrapped up in September of this year. So the outreach kind of informed what the trail should be. The public survey included a fairly small response group of 201. However, we felt that it helped inform the vision for the trail. One of the key questions was to hear what the community vision was for the trail. And if you see here, a total of 86 respondents, 86% of the respondents wanted connected trails, whether it was on the lower left-hand side, the green, 56% wanted a main trail with connections to local trails, or on the upper right-hand side in the blue, the network of connected trails, which was another 30%. Next slide, please. So our technical advisory committee and stakeholder advisory committee helped clarify the local process, the progress and feasibility of early chapter three recommendations. And the levee manager input gave us really good grounding and counterbalancing considerations that we needed to take into consideration. In chapter two, we pair existing conditions maps with discussion of the existing conditions. And these include maps of the levee systems, roadways, bridges, and ferries, regional trails, both planned and existing, transit to trails, boating and waterways, outdoor recreational facilities, and others. So there's pretty extensive mapping providing guidance to local communities that would be developing trails to keep in mind what they need to consider. Next slide, please. Then chapter three introduces the four trail types, as well as the maps of each region. The main trail is the core or the spine of the trail. This will be signed with the primary Delta Trail existing logo medallion that you see on the lower left. Where feasible, these segments would have the broadest range of user types, which would provide the best Delta experience and prioritize connections to legacy communities, public transportation hubs, and other important Delta destinations. Then the local access trails. would meet many of the same criteria as the main trail segments, but they would prioritize connection to the main trail over connections through the Delta. Water launch sites, which you can see the third medallion over from the left that's blue, these would be located along or accessed by a main trail or a local access trail segment, and they can also just be standalone water access sites. Generally, they would meet similar vision use in terms of use, location, and experience as the main trail, but they would relate mainly to, obviously, to water use. Then lastly, we have the adventure hubs, which we introduced as a concept that will be fleshed out much more fully with the National Heritage Area Management Plan. The adventure hubs represent a variety of opportunities, including historical walking tours, kayak or boat launch sites and rentals, bike loops, equestrian loops, bird watching hikes, etc. And these adventure hikes would adventure hubs would serve as destinations within the Delta that can anchor the visitor experience and encourage further exploration by those with maybe less familiarity with the Delta. Next slide, please. So chapter three also includes the bulk of the master plan recommendations, including the maps. And we start with the Western Delta region shown here. These illustrate both existing and proposed trails, as I mentioned earlier, and they provide specific locations for our recommendations. The first two recommendations are for the commission to adopt and apply to the entire system, the four trail types that I just outlined, and create a clear designation checklist to bring transparency and consistency to the trail designation process. So the Western region, of course, is the gateway between the Delta and the Bay Area. There's been extensive planning for trails in Contra Costa County, especially with the East Bay Regional Park District and other agencies. And the land trail recommendations in this region reflect the planning that's been done, as well as previous actions taken by the commission to designate trail segments. So as of this time, 31 miles of existing Delta trail are in this region, with another 31 miles, give or take, of additional planned or proposed Delta Trail. This area also overlaps with the San Francisco Bay Water Trail. So water launch sites in this location, in this region, reflect the recommendations to adopt the existing San Francisco Bay Water Trail sites as Delta Trail water launch sites. And then existing Adventure Hub suggested locations include established recreation opportunities around the Carquinez Strait, Sault Ste. City, and the Oakley-Brentwood area. And again, the Adventure Hubs would be the product of what local communities have developed on their own. Next slide, please. From there, we move up clockwise to our Northern Delta region, which is the gateway into the Delta from Sacramento and West Sacramento. And this is another area which has had a lot of active Delta Trail planning. There's approximately 14 miles of existing Delta Trail that are located here in this region. And our land trail recommendations for the Northern Delta include promoting and supporting existing trails in Sacramento and West Sacramento, mainly with the gap closures where there are some existing gaps, and also supporting the county, Sacramento County, in any future study of feasibility of the Eielton to Stone Lakes Trail. And then some additional support for bike access and bike facilities in the local, regional, and transportation and recreation plans. The adventure hubs obviously suggest focusing on the rich cultural history in Clarksburg, Sacramento, and West Sacramento. Next slide, please. So then we have our Central Delta region, which is the heart of the Delta, includes the five of the legacy communities. Also, obviously, numerous cultural destinations, a handful of local trails, but unfortunately, currently no designated Delta trail segments. So our land trail recommendations focus on potential for designating existing local trails as Delta Trail local access, and then supporting agencies in planning for improved bike and pedestrian crossing, in particular for the San Joaquin River that would get people around a very unsafe Antioch bridge crossing. And our water launch site recommendations in this region focus on support of the existing well-established and very popular water launch sites. Next slide, please. And we conclude the circuit with our southern region map, which covers southeastern Contra Costa County, excuse me, to San Joaquin County and the towns of Stockton, Tracy, and Lathrop. And as with the central region, this region includes a number of local trail systems, but none that are currently designated as Delta Trail segments. So our land trail recommendations here also focus on potential for designating existing and future local trails that will connect, especially trails to connect Stockton to the Delta as local access Delta trails. The plan recommends supporting planned and developed trail networks underway in the River Islands development in Lathrop and the Clifton Four Bay to Bethany Reservoir trail connections being planned by the East Bay Regional Park District. Just to mention here that for the water launch sites, many of our recommendations for water launch water trail launch sites were part of the 2019 Delta Leadership Program class project, which identified potential water launch sites. And next slide, please. Chapter four includes our context sensitive design guidance on trail elements. It focuses on considerations that make trail development different in the Delta from other parts of the state. And the key component is emphasizing context-sensitive design that will be locally led and reflecting local conditions and requirements. So there are very few hard, quote-unquote, requirements for the trail beyond reducing impacts and providing safe access. The chapter does provide guidance and considerations for trails on or near roadways, levees, rail corridors, bridges, and agricultural sites. It also includes guidance and considerations for trail surfaces, trailheads, design of wayfinding signs, and water launch. We also recommend development of a toolkit for trail design. The next slide. Ending with chapter five, the implementation, which discusses the ways to make progress towards a connected Delta Trail network and delves into the process for developing new trails and recommending lead agencies or organizations for each stage. We recommend here production of online and printed maps, updating the Delta sign plan to include Delta Trail recommendations, developing the adventure hubs as part of the National Heritage Area, and developing and supporting Delta Trail events. Next slide, please. So our next steps are to wrap up the public review today, December 16th, and include all of our updated changes from the outreach that occurred between November 18th and today. And we will bring it to our commission on January 20th for consideration of final adoption of the plan. And at that point, we start promoting and implementing trails. So I know I've covered a lot in a very short time, but apologies for running over a little bit, and can take any questions if you have them. Thanks very much. Next slide.
Madam Chair, quick question.
Yes, Don.
Thank you. Virginia, thanks. I'm curious, does the legislation require that counties and cities adopt the trail master plan into their general plans, or is it a guiding document but not necessarily need to be incorporated into the general plans? Because there are certain planning actions that were and are required for our general plans to be consistent with both the Delta plan, obviously, but with commission work as well. So I'm just curious.
I don't believe so, but I would have to double check, and perhaps Erica is aware, but my understanding is that this is simply a guidance document produced by the commission for local governments, but there's no requirement that I'm aware of that these be adopted as with the land use and resource management plan.
Thanks, Virginia.
I believe that's correct.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, then. There is a question.
Oh, hey, Virginia.
Yes, thank you. Virginia, great presentation. Eric, great to see you. As I'm listening to you and I'm looking at all of these different facets, I'm intrigued for so many reasons. One is because I think that this is so desperately needed. But two questions. One is, what is the funding mechanism that you anticipate? I did see fundraising somewhere in there. That's question number one. Question number two is, especially with the Western Delta region portion that you highlighted, I see that there's so many synergies that I think could be created by working with Amtrak San Joaquin's, ACE, with the new expansion of ACE into the Sacramento area, where there should be some collaboration for people to be able to, again, highlight this as, you know, a part of their San Joaquin Amtrak experience, ACE experience. So any thoughts on that?
Yes, thanks for that question. Addressing that one first, actually, we have designated, there's a new Amtrak stop that will be, and an ACE corridor stop that will be developed, and I believe it's in Oakley. And that is definitely part of a Nexus hub for, especially for people reaching, you know, into that southern portion of the Delta for, or western portion of the Delta for different tail opportunities. So we definitely included transit as in our mapping on potential opportunities. And then also in terms of the funding, we have in the appendices one appendix specifically, Appendix F for funding, that lists everything from federal, state, and local funding opportunities. And that would include everything from active transportation, sustainable communities, National Park Service River Trail and Conservation Assistance Program. So there, we've identified a number of different programs, but then part of our role going forward would be doing whatever we can to assist local governments in developing those grant opportunities and certainly advocating for them.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I'm glad you're excited. We are too. Well, thank
Any
you.
Any other questions? Well, thank you both to Eric and Virginia. Great presentation, and I too am very excited. I can't wait to check out these adventure hubs.
Thank you.
So council members and Rachel Klopfenstein and Eric and Virginia, I am so sorry that I am having technical difficulties this morning. And I'm fearful of turning on my video because it seems that when I turn my video on, my system seizes up and then I lose connection. So happy to be connected this way. Mm-hmm. Let's move on to agenda item 10, performance measures 2021 Chair. Year.
Chair, I'm so sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. Public, yes. Thank
Public
you.
Comment, Public yes. comment, yes. We do have one. Deidre Desjardins.
Thank you. I wanted to point out that I think this trail is incredibly important. As I started researching my own nature guardian instincts when I was working with to help save the Delta Independent Science Board, and I realized that the environmental advocacy community is somewhat unique in that very strong motivations to work to protect fish and birds and natural resources. And one of the things that came up there's studies on affective connection with nature, sort of an emotional connection. And that's a primary driver of, the research shows it's a primary driver of protective actions. And so things like the Delta Trail are actually can make a real difference in how much the research is showing, how much people care about the Delta and want to preserve it. So I just wanted to bring that up and to thank the Delta Protection Commission for their really fine work they're doing.
Thank you, Deirdre. Are there any other public comments?
No, there are not.
Great. Thank you, Beck. On to agenda item 10, performance measures 2021 year in review. I'll hand it over to Jessica Pearson.
Okay, thank you so much, Chair. Well, as we approach the end of the year and prepare for the next, we have the opportunity to reflect on progress made in implementing the Delta Plan and also on status and trends of what's happening in the Delta. So today, the Council's Performance Management Unit is going to walk us through our annual year in review of the Delta Plan's performance measures. Measuring progress this way allows us to see improvements in the Delta, as well as setbacks and decline. And the legislature required these performance measures so that we could be informed as we administer the Delta Plan, and as we also think about future updates to that plan and modifications that might be needed. So today we're going to discuss performance measure data updates, progress made by implementing agencies in following through on Delta Plan recommendations, and also steps that the council staff has taken to communicate performance measures and what we're learning from them. We'll also look ahead in the upcoming year with the goal of continuing to communicate and track performance measures to provide the council and other implementing agencies with the information that they need to be used to improve the effectiveness of their programs and actions. With that, I'd like to invite to the table Jeff Henderson, our Deputy Executive Officer for Planning and Performance, Martina Kohler, our Performance Measures Program Manager, Christopher Kwan, a Senior Environmental Scientist, and Corey Copeland, also Senior Environmental Scientist.
All right, thank you, Jessica. And I'm going to go ahead and get us kicked off. Good morning, council members. It's a pleasure to be here to wrap up 2021 as we have the last several years with our performance measure update, reviewing progress over the year with regard to tracking the performance measures that we have adopted. As Jessica mentioned, the Water Code requires that the Delta Plan include quantified or otherwise measurable targets associated with achieving the objectives of the Delta Plan. And for that reason, the Delta Plan includes performance measures that are designed to detect environmental and administrative or policy changes due to the implementation of the various different policies and recommendations throughout the Delta Plan. The Delta Plan contains 154 different performance measures, including 122 measures that track the status of implementing recommendations in the plan, things such as implementing water efficiency and water management planning laws, updating Delta flow objectives, investigating opportunities for carbon markets and the like, as well as 32 output and outcome performance measures that track more kind of indicators of environmental or social conditions using baselines, metrics, and targets. Things like acre feet of Delta water exported, the abundance of native species, the amount of subsidence reversal that's being conducted in the Delta, and the total area, perhaps, of carbon sequestration projects. As you'll hear shortly, the original performance measures were a part of the 2013 Delta Plan. A revised set of performance measures was adopted by the council in 2018 as part of the Delta Plan amendments. And the council has an entire unit, the performance measures unit, who you'll hear from the staff today, that tracks and evaluates these performance measures on an annual basis using an online dashboard as the primary communication tool, but also a number of other innovative means of communicating the value and status of the various different performance measures that are established in the plan. So with that, I'd like to hand it over to Martina Kohler, who is the program manager for our performance management unit, who will carry the rest of the presentation this morning. Thank you, Martina. Good morning.
Morning. Thank you, Jeff. Good morning, Chair Tatayan and council members. So today, before we dive into our annual reporting on the performance measures, I would like to play a short video that our team produced together with the council's communications team. And the video is about performance measures. The video is part of our approach to communicate performance measures to a broad audience in order to explain and to promote understanding about the performance measures, how they were selected, what are the performance measures targets, and how the targets are established. The video stars our performance measures unit staff, Megan Thompson and Chris Kwan. It's about 5 minutes long, so enjoy. So please play the video.
Hi, I'm Megan Thompson from the Delta Stewardship Council Agency.
And I'm Chris Kwan. Megan and I are environmental scientists on the council's Delta Plan Performance Management Team.
At the council, we support science-based decision-making.
One of the ways we do this is by working with our partners to implement the Delta Plan, California's long-term management plan for the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta.
For more than a decade, the Delta Plan has created a vision for addressing the region's current and predicted challenges.
It includes regulations and recommendations to achieve a reliable California water supply and a resilient Delta ecosystem in a way that protects and enhances the Delta as a unique place where people live, work, and recreate. These performance measures were developed, refined, and set between 2013 and 2018.
For the initial selection, our team considered the best available science, existing data, and ongoing monitoring efforts.
Next, we screened the measures to determine which were most related to management of the Delta, feasible and ready for implementation, supported by available data, and able to inform policy decisions.
Lastly, we coordinated technical reviews by the Delta Lead Scientists, the Delta Independent Science Board, state, federal, and local agencies, stakeholders, and other subject matter experts.
The finalized performance measures position us to know where to go, when we need to be there, and how close we are to success. We're now into our third year of tracking performance measures. The Delta supplies a portion of the drinking water for more than 27 million Californians, fuels California's $3 trillion economy, is a biodiversity hotspot with more than 750 plant and animal species, and is the only national heritage area in the state.
The Delta is also a place of historical culture and agricultural significance. More than 500,000 people call this region home.
Many agencies, all with overlapping natural resource or social missions, manage the Delta.
Delta Plan performance measures help us evaluate the effectiveness of their combined efforts.
For example, recent findings from our performance measure that tracks harmful algal blooms, or HABs, in Delta waterways show that reports of toxic algae are increasing, especially during the summer months.
Dangerous levels of harmful algal blooms can harm people and kill animals.
It's important that we track the locations and toxicity levels of HABs.
Other Delta plan performance measures track water exports, timing and magnitude of fresh water flows, invasive species, farmland loss, tourism and recreational opportunities, flood casualties and damages, and subsidence reversal.
These measures demonstrate progress toward achievable yet aspirational performance targets and timelines.
Targets are set by the Council through a multi-step process that includes assembling and reviewing the best available science and data with agency and stakeholder partners and independent scientific reviewers.
The Council, Delta Plan implementing agencies, and scientists use this information to enhance collaborations between Delta resource managers and policymakers.
In conclusion, tracking performance measures gives us a deeper insight in the complexities of the Delta system and allows us to determine and prioritize management efforts and policy responses now and in the future.
All while boosting government accountability and transparency.
To learn more about the Delta Plan performance measures and our work, visit our online dashboard at viewperformance.deltacouncil.ca.gov.
Thanks for watching.
So we can transition back to the PowerPoint presentation. Yeah, second slide, please. So the video will be available on the Council YouTube channel after the showing today. And the video was actually prepared in response to your recommendation, Chair Tatayan, when we presented to you last year. The key message you, I hope, take away from the video is that we now have the performance measures to evaluate how effectively the implementation of the Delta Plan is working. The performance measures use monitoring data and science to reflect where we are between the baselines and targets in relation to the Delta Plan objectives. And with few more years of implementation of the priority actions outlined in the Delta Plan, the performance measures will be able to tell where we are succeeding and where more effort is needed. Next slide. This year, this is the third year of tracking and reporting to you. This is still early in the process to be able to see statistically robust trends across the resource sections, as this is the third year of tracking and the targets are still a few years off. The value is in continued monitoring of the performance portfolio and sharing the updates with you and others. In the report today, we will go over performance highlights from this year. I will present highlights on the Delta ecosystem, the invasive species, and select water quality measures. And then Corey Copeland will present on water supply reliability, Delta tourism, and flood risk reduction. After the annual highlights, I will close with the focus on dashboard uses and what we plan to do next year. So next slide, please. Next slide. So on Delta ecosystem and water quality, first focus on the salinity and maybe a little background. So the water year 2021 was the second driest water year in recent history. This means that the freshwater flow into the Delta was lower than usual, and consequently the salinity intrusion into the Delta was harder to manage. The Delta salinity performance measure tracks how well salinity standards are being met at compliance locations. Salinity standards protect agriculture, municipal, industrial, and fish and wildlife beneficial uses. In 2021, salinity standards were exceeded at three locations in the Delta and one compliance location in the Suisse Marsh. These are marked as the red triangle on the slide, on the map. And overall, this performance measure reflects that during severe drought conditions, it is challenging to maintain low salinity in the Delta. Next slide, please. Toxic algae present in Delta waterways have the potential to harm humans and wildlife. The performance measure tracks locations of the harmful algal blooms, voluntary sightings in Delta and Susan Marsh waterways. These incidents are then confirmed and assigned a public health advisory level. HAPS reports in the Delta have almost doubled in 2021 compared to 2019 and 2020. The HAPS in waterways used for swimming and recreation are an important public health. They impact water quality and health of wildlife and Delta residents and visitors. Next slide. Invasive species is a very important management issue in the Delta because invasive species affect native species, native ecosystems, modified physical habitat, and also impact human uses such as recreation, navigation, and infrastructure stability. One of the invasive species performance metrics is prevention of establishing new invasive populations. Unfortunately, a newly establishing aquatic vegetation species this year is the ribbonweed. Ribbonweed has been spotted in a few locations in the Delta, and currently the California Department of Fish and Agriculture, Department of Food and Agriculture is assessing invasiveness rating of ribbonweed and is proposing second highest rating and to conduct risk assessments. The other species on the watch list for newly establishing populations is the nutria. Nutria is a semi-aquatic rodent that can damage natural vegetation and also burrow deep into the levees. Nutria are actively managed and controlled in the region with the goal of eradication. And this year numbers indicate actually success of the program and a hopeful sign that nutria numbers are lowering. Next slide. And the last water quality topic to highlight today is the issue of mercury and its presence in waterways, wetlands, and fish. The Central Valley Regional Water Quality Control Board runs a program to control mercury in the Delta and is using recommendations from the independent scientific review completed this year to establish mercury control methods for the Delta. So with this, I would like to close our the ecosystem and water quality update and pass it along to Corey to give updates on the water supply reliability, Delta tourism, and reduced Delta flood risk. Corey?
Yeah, thank you, Martina. Next slide, please. Yeah, as was mentioned in the video, about 27 million Americans rely on the Delta for some portion of their water supply, which, you know, it amounts to about 1 in 12 Americans. So water supply reliability from the Delta is extremely important, and that's reflected in the Delta Plan, which supports the strategy of investing in improving regional water supplies, conservation, and water efficiency. In addition to the Delta Plan recommending this, there are also state laws on the books, such as the Urban Water Management Planning Act and some follow-on legislation that require individual urban water suppliers to develop urban water management plans. Those are required for any urban water supplier that delivers more than 3,000 acre feet of water annually or serves more than 3,000 urban connections. The planning process is meant to ensure that suppliers have an appropriate level of reliability in their water service area to meet the needs of the various categories of customers, especially during dry and multiple dry years. And so in addition to urban water suppliers making urban water management plans, there's also agricultural water management plans. Those plans exist to address the need to evaluate and improve efficiency of agricultural water management. As I said, these are done every 5 years, and this is the year that the urban water management plans were submitted to DWR for evaluation. They will additionally be approved over the next several months, or reviewed and hopefully approved over the next several months, and then we expect the agricultural water management plans to be submitted over the course of next year. So the Delta Plan we understand that we're not an implementing agency, and that in order for us to achieve that statewide strategy, a lot of these actions have to be done by water suppliers and at a more local level. So In order to, for us to achieve our statewide goal of reduced reliance on the Delta and improved reliability, we understand that water management planning at the local level is really a key part of that. Next slide. And so that's reflected in the Delta plan and its policies. So specifically policy WRP1 requires covered actions to demonstrate reduced reliance on Delta water. And one way in order for a supplier to demonstrate a measurable reduction in Delta water is through a calculation in an urban water management plan or agricultural water management plan. Through outreach efforts with DWR and water suppliers, we saw for the first time the establishment of a methodology, an example methodology for preparing this form of measurement in the agricultural and urban water management plans. That is tracked in our administrative performance measure, WRR051, which asks for the preparation of this, what's called a water supply reliability element. And so we're very excited to see that for the first time, Appendix C of the 2020 Urban Water Management Plan Guidebook includes a method for water suppliers to measure reduced reliance on Delta water. Next slide. In addition to reduced reliance, the Delta plan performance measures use a substantial amount of data from the urban and agricultural water management plans in order to inform some of our most important metrics on water supply. One of those is urban water use, which tracks per capita gallons per day of water use from urban water suppliers who rely on the Delta or its watershed for water. Additionally, we look at alternative water supply, which we define as desalination, recycled water, and stormwater capture. And so we look at what projects are being planned and what have been implemented and track progress towards those goals set in the individual plans. Additionally, we look at water supply reliability across single and multiple dry years to identify what portion of water suppliers relying on Delta water are demonstrating reliability during dry years. And then lastly, we track agricultural water efficiency reporting in the agricultural water plans. And so these updates will occur sometime in the next year. So this is kind of looking forward because for the moment we're waiting on DWR to review the urban water management plans. But once they have completed their review, we will be able to make those updates to view performance. Next slide. So the next topic will be Delta tourism. I think as we know, and also had the opportunity to talk about at this meeting, tourism and recreation in the Delta are a key part of what makes the Delta's place such a compelling place for the state and for visitors. And so we have a strategy to encourage recreation and tourism and allow visitors to enjoy and appreciate the Delta. And in order to track our success at that, we have a series of metrics under performance measure 5.8. And I won't go through all of these, but I do want to highlight that we are for the first time able to report on off-season visitors. So in the past, we didn't have the data available to report on seasonality of visitors. But as a result of efforts from the DPC in updating their economic sustainability plan and some of the underlying work that they did through surveys to inform that report, we are able to report on seasonality. Next slide, please. And so as we had expected, there is a significant bias in seasonality in the Delta as far as recreation goes, where we find that the winter season really is the off season and accounts for about half as much tourism as occurs in any of the other seasons. And so, we're now able to offer numbers to describe that. And, I think these type of metrics are very important to the Stewardship Council and have come up in recent actions, such as, Lookout SLU, where we understanding the importance of data on tourism and recreation certainly has come into play. as well as looking at efforts by DPC through their ESP and also some of the Delta Trail Master Planning and presumably the National Heritage Act work that they are doing. Next slide. So one of the key responsibilities vested in the Stewardship Council is to reduce risk to people and property in the Delta from flooding and other emergency situations. And so one of the ways that we have responded to that at the Stewardship Council is the Delta Levee Investment Strategy, which uses a tool that allows us to produce estimates for the annual expected fatalities and annual expected damages in the Delta that could occur from flooding. And keep in mind that these are annualized, so any individual flood would be far greater than these estimates potentially, kind of represents the ongoing risk. We have a performance measure, which is a performance measure 7.2 that tracks these annual expected damages and fatalities with a target of a 50% reduction in each. Next slide. We were pleased to see that a result of our update to DLIS is that we have for now achieved our target of a 50% decrease in both annual expected damages and annual expected fatalities. We believe that this is a result of two factors. So the first factor is that we have improved the methods that we're using to calculate annual expected damages and annual expected fatalities. And then the second is that we were able to account for almost a decade of levee improvement investments in the region through an update to a digital elevation model that shows us the changes to the levee elevations in the region. And so those updates kind of show a substantial reduction in the risk that we believe exists in the system. So to put it in context, from 2012 to 2021, about 10.25 annual expected fatalities were predicted by the DLIS analysis tool. That is down to 3.9, which represents, more than 60% reduction. However, I do want to caution that in the Delta, flood risk isn't stationary. As a result of climate change, we know and believe that flood risk will actually be ever increasing due to the natural conditions of sea level rise and new inflows from increased intensity of atmospheric rivers. And so we think continued investment in the levees remains a very important action, and that we have to continue to prioritize and be wise in our investments in order to continue to meet our goals for reduced risk to people and property. And so with that, I want to pass it back to Martina to wrap up our presentation.
Thank you, Corey. So now we are moving into how our performance measures are communicated. Next slide. You have heard the highlights from the annual updates today, and all this information is and more is available on the Council Performance Measures dashboard. The dashboard is Council's key tool to report the data, and I hope you have already had a chance to browse and explore the website. We track website analytics to understand, so we track website analytics to understand how many viewers use the tool and which pages they view. So for example, during this year, the dashboard had more than 14,000 total page views, averaging about 1,300 page views each month. Though the number may sound high, this is actually slightly lower than we had the previous year. This may be due to limited communications we have done this year due to remote work and limited presentation opportunities. The performance measure pages were accessed by about 250 users monthly on average. Harmful algal blooms page is the most visited page beside the home, the landing page, with the highest access rate actually during the summer months. And additionally, salinity, water exports, subsidence, yellow bypass, and invasive species were also popular performance measures. And again, because of the work from home, we are not able to track agency domains accessing the dashboard this year. Therefore, it's harder to conclude who is using the dashboard from these available numbers. But overall, the web viewership numbers indicate a broad and steady use of the dashboard. From my perspective, this is really important to make sure that users understand that there is a team behind the dashboard and that the performance measures are being actively tracked and frequently updated. And the other point here is that we cannot expect that people will find the tool themselves. While they can get to the dashboard from the council website, it is really important to spread the word about the tool and to communicate the importance of the performance measures proactively. So with that, maybe next steps for the next year. Maybe like now we can move to the next slide. And one more slide. Thank you. So in the upcoming year, we will continue focus on the communication and leveraging the communication methods we have at the council and to renew our focus on any additional outreach techniques. So this may include producing a sequel to the video, focusing on specific technical aspects of Delta Plan goal and the associated performance measure. And we will look for opportunities to present at specialty conferences and other gatherings, develop digital posters, and potentially a topic-focused podcast. Additionally, next year, we will finalize proposing revisions to the administrative performance measures to better align the tracking, the implementation actions with emerging policies and some of the key water resilience and climate actions. So with that, I would like to close the presentation and open for any questions or comments. Thank you.
Any questions for the performance measures team? Don.
Yeah. Not so much questions, Madam Chair, but certainly just some brief comments. I wanted to certainly thank the folks for all the work that goes into this, and I think making it widely available is really important because, I think it certainly focuses on the importance of the role that both the council and the commission and the conservancy that were either constituted or reconstituted out of the Reform Act, but also then obviously the adoption of the Delta Plan and how that aligns with both the commission's agricultural natural resources plan and other elements of the Protection Commission's work, but certainly with the county general plans and city general plans. And I found it fascinating too that in Corey's comments that, we saw the number earlier, 27 million Californians have some ties to the Delta as relates to water, but obviously all of us as Californians, they need to recognize the importance. But when he stated as 1 in 12 Americans and put it in that context, I think it even brings a greater emphasis to importance of the Delta, not only from the standpoint of the two co-equal goals and the very important qualifier, but when you think about how important it is to California and certainly the estuary and all of its various components, environmental and certainly the communities that constitute the Delta, the legal Delta, it really is. I think it brings, at least to my mind, how relevant the work is that the council does, the commission does, as well as the conservancy, the various aspects of their roles. But also when you think the number of species, the hundreds of species, the fact that the Delta, both from an environmental standpoint, but from an agricultural standpoint, it's a food basket for not just for the state, but for the nation and the world. In my words, I just think it's a place of wonder, of awe, and certainly of vital importance. And I want to just compliment the staff with the council and all the various partners. And as we hear about the science and we hear about the ongoing research, as we see these performance measures, and again, kudos to the council. I wasn't a member when the direction was given around actually putting this in an annual plan. And I think having it available on a website, but also in printed form, It's a very useful document. It's a very useful tool. And I know a lot goes into it. And I think it just continues to, re-energize, hopefully, all of us, and call attention to the importance of the Delta from so many different vantage points. And I think the work that's ongoing to understand it and to protect it and all of its various aspects. And so again, I just want to thank certainly Jessica and Jeff and Martina and Corey and all the others who, presented here, both on the video, but also contribute to this work, because it's, to me, it's vital. It's vital to the Delta, and certainly to our state and to the nation. So thanks again. And I told Jessica in my briefing earlier in the week that, just reading through the document, I learned a number of different things, certainly because of its breadth and some of the depth that you go into in measuring, how things are going, where we're doing well, where we're, where we have need to continue to bring focus to, see a constant improvement. But I just want to thank our staff for their good work. And I think that this document certainly proves the value of the Delta Reform Act and all the various components and all the work that goes on from the council level, but also with our partners in the commission and the conservancy, and obviously all the other related entities that were mentioned, that both state, federal, and certainly local. Thank you very much.
Thank you for those comments, Don. It means a lot.
Yes, thank you, Don. Virginia.
Yes, I just want to echo Don's comments. I thought they were spot on, and I'm a very visual person, and so the video I thought was great. I think you guys did a fantastic job for it being a staff-produced video. Doesn't sound like you guys hired a professional, but you guys are professionals, so great job on that. I thought it did an excellent job of explaining again the work that goes behind all of this. So again, just want to reiterate Don's comments. Job well done. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Well, I want to chime in and echo the thank you. And thank you so much for working so hard on the performance measures. And I just want to remind folks that these performance measures took quite a while to develop. And it's very, very difficult in such a system to distill so many parameters and factors and the science down into performance measures. And it's so refreshing to see that we're in the third year. And I have to tell you, I'm going to have to mute here. I just want to say thank you so much. It's people, other agencies are referring to the dashboard. The work is making a great difference. And thank you for a great presentation and video. Any public comments on this item?
Yes, Madam Chair. We have Deidre Desjardins.
Thank you. Deidre Desjardins with California Water Research. And I just wanted to observe managing the Delta is a wicked problem. And it's getting worse with climate change. And the Delta Stewardship Council was created in part to solve some of the governance issues. And I just wanted to read you that the role of the lead scientist under Water Code 85280 is to have the capability to guide the application of an adaptive management process to resource management policy decisions in the Delta. So the Delta Stewardship Council was intended to be a lot more than just a passive convener of, agencies
And these performance measures are really important. And I was aware that the adaptive management process is critical for climate change. I encourage you to do some critical looking at this, as it with the Delta smelt going extinct likely this year. I mean, they've caught one. It's a bit like the operation was successful, but the patient died. I mean, it has been a decade, and I do remember the enormous hope after in 2010, the Water Board had a set of hearings about appropriate Delta flow criteria and what would be needed to restore the Delta ecosystem, and a huge number of environmental and fishing groups I work with participated in that. And then there's been a huge delay in the flows and implementing it. And some of the reasons were that there just hasn't been any kind of hard push to make the hard decisions that are needed. And as you know, there's a lot of political impetus behind delaying. So, you know, being a truth teller and this inconvenient truth, I just want to urge the council to really think about this and take a hard look at the, you know, this is tough, and we need to not sugarcoat it and look at, you know, both the successes, and I think it's been phenomenal, the outreach and the development, but also how we could do better. So thank you.
Thank you, Deirdre. We're getting some interesting sounds. So at the risk of losing you or losing my connection, I'm going to turn on my video and see what happens. Let's see here. I'm still here. I'm still connected. Yay. Well, if there are there any other public comments on this item?
No, Madam Chair, there are not.
Thank you, Beck. Well, let's move on to the final agenda item, preparing for our next council meeting. The next council meeting is January 27, 2022. Can you believe that? It's already looking at 2022. I wish you all safe and enjoyable holidays and a healthy and enriching new year. Thank you for your attention and your patience today with our technical challenges. And thank you, everybody, for being here. And the meeting is adjourned. We'll see you next year.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
Happy holidays. Chair Katayan.
Happy holidays.
And thank you, Vice Chair, for stepping up.
Thank you. Yes, thank you, Virginia.
Yeah, thanks, Virginia.
It was a test. And
I didn't intend the test. But so.
It's all good. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays. Bye.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.